Good morning. I'm calling the Senate Education Committee to order at 8 a.m. on Friday, March 3rd. Today we have President Senator Coghill. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Senator Begich, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And I'm Chair Hughes. And this morning, Senator Giesel and Stevens have other obligations and are excused. So let's remember our phone etiquette, and let's also thank Nancy Jones and Ben Manley with the LIO for helping us out today. We had Dr. Wicker with us a few weeks ago when we ran short on time, so we've invited him back. He's a wealth of knowledge on the issue of broadband and what we've been looking at as far as using technology to open up our opportunities for our students to great teachers and more course offerings. And so we've invited him back. And then once he is finished, we'll also have the first hearing for SB 66, which is sponsored by all of us, the Senate Education Committee, that I spoke with members about earlier, an act redesignated the Alaska State Council of Arts as a public corporation. So we will start out by welcoming Dr. Wicker. If you would please introduce yourself. He is online, I believe, and your affiliation, and please tell us everything you know that we need to know if we want to move forward in this direction, Dr. Wicker.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate this opportunity. My name is Dr. Robert Wicker. I'm director for the Association of Alaska School Boards Consortium for Digital Learning. And, I just really appreciate this time. I wish I could be there in person, and I know that your time is valuable, and that you have many important issues in front of you. So, am I coming through okay?
Yes, we can hear you nicely. Thank you.
Okay, great. So I've kind of seen how these phone testimonies go, and I'll present some information, and then take a breath so that if there are questions, we'll be able to ask them. So. I've watched the testimony from many of the entities that have come before you, and I'm going to try to bridge that message that they've been delivering, and then bring an added perspective from our experience of the Consortium for Digital Learning. From previous testimony, you've seen that schools are making progress towards using digital learning and online learning. But they face challenges in bringing this type of learning to all students. To me, it's prudent to keep the overall goal in mind. Access to the appropriate technology for desired teaching and learning outcomes is what is transformational about this discussion. The ubiquitous access to digital learning and appropriate teaching tools that promote the types of educational experiences we desire, that's the thing that makes the difference. The power of the technology tools we use provides nimbleness, effectiveness, increased opportunities, and the potential for academic achievement that are just not available without it. Improved broadband and higher technology adoption in our schools adds tools so that we can get to these things. In previous testimony, I've outlined how the Consortium for Digital Learning has been an active advocate for the advancement of digital learning for all students in K-12 in Alaska since 2005. With the support of the Alaska legislature, we've assisted over 140 schools to implement one-to-one laptop and tablet programs, and districts have continued or expanded those programs also. We've continued to advance digital learning in Alaska by creating examples of collaboration between districts, working with vendors to develop unique solutions to our challenges, and conducting demonstration projects and programs that result in higher learning and systemic change. These projects were great learning environments that laid the groundwork for where digital learning has progressed today in our state. It's important to note that our successful implementations of digital learning advance by controlling variables that can be controlled and working around those that can't. Let me repeat that again, because that's a big deal. successful implementations control variables that can be controlled and work around those that can't. Sometimes this means learning to use the broadband you have to amplify and accelerate learning with the technology that is available. Improving and sustaining our broadband services will no doubt greatly improve opportunities for our students, and it's very worthwhile to pursue. Yet, while broadband is a crucial aspect of digital learning, improved broadband alone doesn't guarantee an improved educational outcome without addressing other aspects of digital learning. Commitment, innovation, wise use of resources, and use of district strengths have much to do with our successful implementations. So the topics I'd like to address today are four. One is the types of learning broadband and the use of technology avails. Two is the level of broadband and technology for a blended learning educational model for our state. Three, other challenges that we've seen and possible solutions for those. And four, a foundation of a plan for moving forward. So with that, you should have a few documents in front of you. And the first one I'd like to go briefly through is titled Use of Bandwidth Within Instruction. You have that in front of you?
Okay.
It's the third page. Yep.
See, you all are finding it. Okay.
Yeah, there should be four rectangles on there. So we'll just go down through this. I'll take a couple of minutes to go through each one of these examples. These examples are promising innovations that we've seen across our state that modernize our instruction for increased efficiencies and expansion of offerings, to say the very least. At the top of the graphic, I think you've probably seen these numbers before, but thought it would be good to put those out there again. The recommendations for bandwidth in our school from the State Education Technology Directors Association, and then also from President Obama's Connect Ed initiative, which goes through the FCC, is one megabit per user. The goal that it is referring to is a 1 gigabit per 1,000 students, and that's how you get the 1 megabit per student. And we'll be talking about kilobits, and so the 1 megabit is 1,000 kilobits, which that recommendation, which is totally just a recommendation, in and of itself presents an issue with Alaska and our school sizes. That figure is presently beyond a great majority of Alaska school districts and schools, and far beyond those in rural Alaska. So if you go to the upper left-hand corner of your graphic, that's an example of online learning.
Dr. Wicker, I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. Because we don't have slides, I just want to let those that might be watching that this document is online under BASIS for this, so folks can look it up.
Great.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've defined online learning, simple definition of delivery of core courses and core and content online. And you've heard from the Digital Teaching Initiative grantee districts, and Ketchikan Digital Academy is the one that's highlighted here. So their main vendors are Canvas and Edgenuity. The learning management software platforms are widely used across the state. Ketchikan serves 14 partner schools across districts. And while offering courses through their Digital Teaching Initiative grant, they've built that around a model of $250 per course cost to participants. The bandwidth recommendations come from their vendors. That's from 384 to 512 kilobits per concurrent user. And other course providers across the state and other schools specify up to 1.5 megs per student for their services. And in areas of low bandwidth, a media appliance or caching server helps provide content that does not need to be live. The important lessons we've learned from this, I think, and it pretty much goes across the Digital Teaching Initiative districts, is that the on-site adults at the site at distance to supervise the learning is crucial. That person needs to have a good rapport with the students and be able to motivate them. And also that a central provider really enables success and ease of use by consolidating efforts, streamlining the administration, and providing needed expertise and professional development to that end user site. On the upper right of your handout, we highlight virtual telepresence and teleconference. That's where we get into the delivery of instructional content, professional development, and special services from inside or outside the district through video. We've highlighted Kodiak Island School District. In Kodiak, classes are taught from Kodiak to their villages through video conferencing, including courses such as welding, music, fine arts courses, and even coaching of sports teams. They also use video conferencing robots for teacher professional development from instructors in the lower 48. That involves substantial cost savings to them. Broadband connections serve their village and school over satellite, and there's a fiber terrestrial connection in Kodiak proper. Other school districts across our state, they're delivering content inside and outside of their district from video conferencing studios, outside technical and special services, as well as professional development, are also being delivered around our state through mobile robots using telepresence. So bandwidth recommendation from the vendors for this type of video conferencing in static implementation, that classroom setting, is a dedicated 2 megs up and down. Districts are being successful using less bandwidth than that, employing expensive equipment and skilled technical expertise. Often that expertise is from the internet service provider.
Dr. Wicker, you mentioned, I'm not sure, did you say mobile robot? And can you tell us what that is? I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Great question. It's kind of an exciting thing. We have been working with a company called Double Robots. They are a Segway-based robot. So they're on two wheels, like a Segway, have a gyroscope that keeps them up and vertical. And then they utilize iPads. So an iPad is mounted into the robot. And then a user, such as, let's say, I could be controlling a robot in Kodiak by logging in over the internet, and I could be rolling around through the school or in a classroom and engaging with students, delivering instruction. And in the case in Kodiak, they have a reading remediation program that is run out of California, and the teachers are actually using those robots within the classroom.
Dr. Wicker, would the robot, would a teacher off-site be able to, like, roam a classroom and then, you know, like, roll up to a student's desk? Is that what is part of this, just like a teacher, if it were he or she were live in the room, would be able to walk around the room? Is that what this robot is in its purpose, or?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's what it is, and that ability to be mobile makes some of it. It takes away some of the issues that we have in a static type of an environment where we just have a couple of TV screens up in the front of the room. So that person who's managing that robot, who's actually driving the robot, is able to move freely throughout the classroom, come up beside a student and see their work, interface with them, roll on over in another part of the classroom and join a small group of students, let's say, or go right up beside the teacher and help to coach or give pointers or mentor them.
Wow. I'm glad I asked the question because we kind of glossed over that. So this is really opening up a quite a whole different aspect. So Kodiak is actually doing that now, where a teacher is controlling the robot and coming up and seeing what the work is looking like at the student's desk?
Yes, they do. They're usually mostly for professional development, although the robots are in hot demand there. They have a fleet of about 15 of them, maybe a little bit more. And just in one of the instances that has been that I haven't seen, but I've talked to them quite a bit about this, is that they actually have a coach who has combined students from different villages into one team, and they practice separately. But he's on the robot, basically rolling up and down the basketball court, coaching. So I think this, while there are other robots out there too, and not just double robots, but that it pretty much gives us an idea about what could be possible with the proper commitment and also training.
It is the 21st century. Continue. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So the lower left in your handout highlights high access learning environments. And in this environment, teachers and students use technology to amplify their learning by researching, creating content and digital products, and communicating through email, video, and audio. A dedicated digital device per student is recommended for maximum impact here. And those devices are used at various times during the day as appropriate. Students are not on the device all day long. They're using them as a tool throughout their classes. Teachers moving through levels of technology adoption are central to this blended learning approach. Like I said before, we've got over 140 schools that have some sort of one-to-one program serving some students. And a few smaller school districts have all students with a per-user device-to-student ratio. Our recommendations on this are based on our experience and also just what we've seen as far as technology adoption of teachers go. And that 500 kilobytes per concurrent user is a good number to allow for basic productivity and WAN and cloud access. Many schools with one-to-ones have less bandwidth per student, and they use shaping and network filtering to still meet their goals. And of course, as usual, the use of extensive streaming of video requires more bandwidth. We've learned some important lessons here, and one is that professional development of teachers is critical. That's born out of doctoral studies. There's a very high correlation between how much teachers use the technology to the amount of district professional development that's offered over time. And that this high-access learning environment is a fundamental change, and that needs leadership commitment, sustained funding, many layers of project support, focused curricular goals, and community support, very important. In the lower right hand of your handout, our example there is collaborative learning. This is a very exciting thing, I think. Our example here is the World Bridge Project between Copper River School District, Kodiak Island School District, Trillium Learning, and NASA, the space agency. Kodiak has sent two teams of high school students with this project to what's called the Europa Challenge in Italy. It's a very high-level competition between businesses and universities, and they've won the competition both times. They won't let them compete in the high school division. They make them compete in the business and university category. that the project between Copper River and Kodiak had teams working across districts to design, build, and launch pre-earthquake sensors into high altitude as an experiment in gathering sensitive data for this project. Copper River students designed the rocket at their site, and Kodiak used computer imaging, 3D printing, and sensor modification to design the payload at their site. The launch was more than successful. Students and teachers use teleconferencing and video conferencing, and they use an online platform called Basecamp, and that's a project management piece of software used for creativity and the sharing and tracking of learning activities and projects. That pretty much takes the same type of bandwidth requirement that our high access learning environments, because we're pretty much in a device per user type of a scenario there too. So those are the four areas I'd like to highlight, and if there are questions before moving on, I can sure respond to those.
Dr. Wicker, in the top right corner on the virtual telepresence and video conferencing, you have 2 megabytes per video unit. And so is that video unit for each, let's say, laptop that's streaming the video, or would that be per class that's using video? Or can you just tell us what, so we understand when you say per video unit what you mean?
Yes, yes, Madam Chair, the 2 megs per robot is that's what the robot actually uses, or that's what's recommended. Quite frankly, Kodiak is using less bandwidth per robot than that, but that's what's recommended by the vendor. The 2 megs per video unit that's dedicated is what is recommended for a static VTC classroom. And there again, people are using less bandwidth for that, but it all has to do with quality of the picture. So there has been, in some instances, and with some vendors, there's a recommendation for 4 megs per video unit per classroom. But I think we wanted to take that middle road and recommend the 2 megs.
Again, so it's per, if I have 30 students in a classroom and they're each watching on their own laptop, would that be 60 that would be needed? Or are we talking per the video that's streaming?
Yes, Madam Chair, what we're referring here to is like a unit, like a Polycom unit. Or in our instance, we have some old equipment called Tandberg, and that would be a classroom with 1 camera with a couple of screens on it, and that would you could have 30 students sitting in that room, but they would all be watching one screen, and so that would be that unit.
Okay, so it'd be 2 for that classroom.
Right. When you get into the high access learning environments, that's why you see. That's your bottom left-hand corner. That's why you see a 500 kilobit per user recommendation there. So that if you had 20 students in a classroom all trying to do video conferencing, you would need a heck of a lot of bandwidth. Okay? So that's really not. Not what we would recommend as a strategy, although when we get to our next use of broadband scenarios, I think that might clear a little bit of this up, too.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
Okay. So if you could go to the next 2 documents titled School Broadband Use Scenarios in Alaska, we'll go through that.
Okay, we're there.
Okay, great. So, in our experience, if we're going to establish a distance delivery or blended learning model utilizing online learning, then we need to establish the kinds of learning activities we desire for our children and then get to that bandwidth requirement. So with that in mind, this graphic shows what level of broadband are needed at the school level when there are numbers of students using different learning modalities. In this document, the broadband speeds needed for various types of learning and administrative activities are indicated in the top charts. The amount of bandwidth needed is dependent on what's going to go on in the school and how many students are involved in that activity at the same time. So if you look at the middle of the top chart that it says recommended bandwidth, you see general internet use and online testing and a recommendation of 500 kilobits per student. Online courses, a recommendation of 384 kilobits per student, and that's on vendor recommendation. That's a recommendation from Edgenuity, which is probably the major vendor within our state. And then we have a BTC classroom via robot, so that's the 2 megs per robot that we were talking about. And then a BTC classroom, which is a classroom with that static camera in it with the one or two flat screens that we're broadcasting on, and that's the 2 megabits dedicated up and down. So we've done two scenarios for you here. The first one is the scenario of a 200 student school. So that's let's look at that one. So there, what we've done is come up with a low usage, average usage, and high usage of bandwidth. And this is of educational uses. It does not take in things like administrative use or business type scenarios that the district may use or the school may use. So if we go to scenario one column, okay, those uses are listed over on the left hand side, and then as we move down through that blue column, you can see that in this low usage scenario, we have 140 students who are offline, working without the internet. Now, they may still be using digital devices, but they aren't on the internet. And the next line, we have 40 students using general internet use or online testing. If it's time to do testing, we have 40 of those going on. We have 10 students taking online courses on their own device. So they would be logging in to some vendor to take those courses. And we don't have any robots at all within the school, but we have one BTC classroom and 10 students are sitting in that. Okay? So with that, when you total that up, that total recommended bandwidth comes to about 26 megs, which is about 129 kilobits per student. Okay, so that's our low usage. You can go through the next scenarios and kind of work your way through here to see that we're moving with more and more students getting online and using broadband. Quite frankly, we show this, but I think that our middle ground, the average usage, is probably a pretty good idea of a what I would call a digital school. High usage is you would have that would take dramatic restructure of a school. So if I'm looking at scenario three in the yellow, I've only got 20 kids who are offline. I doubt if we'd ever have that. But we might. If you have 100 kids taking online courses. So half of the school would be engaged in an online course at the same time. Okay? Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense, but when I think of some of the small rural schools where there might only be 25 students, that it makes it a little more achievable where we might need to be beaming in some great teachers. Do you agree?
Right. Yes, I do. And so let's move to that second page. So in this scenario, This is a small size school of 40 kids. And it's got the same numbers on it, except now we're in that small school, which I was just in one last week doing a workshop on some digital storytelling. So that's, and it was about a school of 40 kids. So this kind of fits. So if you look at our low usage scenario for that small school of 40 kids, and we have 20 kids offline, and I can tell you that can be pretty much, you know, that can be pretty much your grades 1 through 3 or 4. They may be offline. And we had 10 kids projected for just general internet use, online testing, whatever, and 6 taking online courses, and 1 DTC class that four kids were in. The school I was in this last week had 6 high school students. So with that, the total recommendation for bandwidth comes around 9, 10 megs. I might add, too, when we're talking about this with megabits and kilobits, I really don't think we're trying to hit the center of the bullseye. Quite frankly, in my world, I think we're trying to hit the broadside of the bar. And if we can, because there are ways to deal with this, with shaping and network management and all that kind of stuff going on. So if we can get there, and it's pretty interesting that when we came through this with recommendations, we're pretty close to the 10 megs that were part of that with the bag grants, right? So if you increase the use of video conferencing and go to a high use scenario, and you have most everyone using the internet in some way, shape, or form, and we're still under 20 meds for that school, and we're right at the 500 kilobits per second per student recommendation. Hopefully that makes sense.
It does, but the in the top band on the right, where it tells us where our districts stand, looks like we have half of our districts per student are still below 100 kilobytes. So that's it seems, is that where you think we should be focusing?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think so. But you again, you have to understand that this is 2014 bandwidth. And that, quite frankly, I think was either before the bag grants got approved or before they were implemented. So I would say, this is just it's better than hitting the broadside of a barn, but I would say that most all of our schools are right around that 10 meg figure now, which would put them up around the, 150 to 200 kilobits. That would be my guess, and you can't hold me to that, but that's what I kind of see that's out there.
Is it possible for you to give us a list of where the 53 or 54 school districts are, including Mount Edgecombe, an updated chart of, do you have that information, or is 2014 the most recent information you have?
Yes, Madam Chair, that 2014 is the best data that we have that's publicly available. Now, I think you've had the ISPs in front of you testifying, and I'm not sure where they are with this as far as what that list looks like now. When I get to this next part, that was going to be one of the things that I think that we need to do is we collected that data in 2014 through a grant, and it really does need to be done again. It's just figuring out how to get it done.
How much was that grant to get that data for 2014?
That grant came through the State Broadband Task Force money, that was after the state broadband task force was done. There were some funds left over from that, and that was around, it was $500,000 that was budgeted. And while we were not administering that, that was Connect Alaska that was doing that. I think they pretty much used most of the grant to get it done. Now, that was a very ambitious thing because it had never been done before. We had people from AASB who physically visited 38 districts to verify the information. And that also took in not just the bandwidth, but it was a survey of the school infrastructure and also school plans for the use of technology.
Dr. Wicker, would you don't have to answer this now, but would you be able to let us know what you think it might take to update? It wouldn't probably take traveling to all the sites now, but to update that 2014 information, what that might cost, so we'd have a better idea of where we stand?
Madam Chair, I can do that, and I can tell you that it will be dramatically less this time around.
Okay, good. Are there other questions that members have?
I have many questions, but why don't we wait until she's done with this presentation?
Okay, sounds good. You're more patient than I am, Senator Beckett.
Okay.
Go ahead, Dr. Wicker.
I'll move on to the next thing. I think I'd like to move on to what's as important as the availability of broadband. Effective distance education has to include a comprehensive approach to overcoming barriers, both technical and human. One is having the necessary equipment. Much can be done with the level of equipment that we now have in our schools. Almost all of our rural schools have equipment. But there are widespread issues of having older equipment not being refreshed and systems being outdated throughout our state. Whether it's small or urban. The majority of our students do not have access to a personal device provided by the school. But that said, many rural districts and larger districts are working hard to include distance delivery and greater digital learning as a main model of course and class delivery. One thing we have to keep an eye on is our reliance on E-rate. E-rate reimbursements are crucial to Alaska education and provide the basis for internet service providers to even consider schools as anchor tenants. When hiccups occur with E-rate, especially in rural Alaska, it can knock the wind out of districts. Even with E-rate subsidies, districts tend to buy the level of bandwidth they can afford and not necessarily all they need. I talked about the data collection, and that was one area that I really see would be helpful if we're going to be moving into this area of distance delivery as a main educational model. But just as significant as those are human issues. We've learned through our experience that implementation of without adequate support systems present many challenges. A number of issues, mostly human ones, all must be addressed to improve the opportunity for success. I think you've heard much testimony about a teacher using distance delivery and that teacher having to know how to engage students who learn with different styles of learning. What works for one student may not work for all. We know, you and I both know, that sitting and listening to a straight lecture from a talking head is not an engaging methodology for many students. Connection, relationship, and work on engaging content and projects and activities are possible with distance education. You know, even in my work life, I've come to know people through phone and video and email, and we form lasting friendships and relationships working to accomplish great things. But when we're working with children in a distance education model, we have to think about having that caring adult physically present with a rapport to the student and to the distance teacher. And that's what's going to build a strong model there. So that brings me to the lack of ongoing professional development and adequate pre-service programs. And that is very significant when where teacher roles are changing. Many teachers get rudimentary professional development regarding the use of applications and software, but seldom get more. Sometimes just basic things like cheat sheets and instructional tutorials, which could really help alleviate issues, they're just not there. As demand for professional development time for mandated trainings and other information grow, the important learnings of the changes needed in classroom management using technology, workflows made possible, learning structures, assessment strategies, they're often neglected. And really what's needed is a commitment and a prioritization of a blended professional development model. You know, many times we see a disconnect between technology departments and what's actually happening in the classroom. It is a real balancing act between network and equipment management by the technology departments and how and when technology gets used by the classroom teacher. If it's going to be viewed as a main instructional strategy, technology just has to work. We've seen how technical difficulties bring a system to its knees or greatly diminish learning opportunities. You know, the fortunate thing is that it will just work if it's properly configured and maintained. But even when the tech department gets things working, many times they focus on just keeping it working rather than what's been focused on how it works in the classroom. A lockdown mentality of permissions, passwords, and teachers not having a level of administrative access to equipment are major barriers to be effective and for efficient use of the technology. It's really not uncommon to go into a school and see equipment not being used because overcoming these issues takes too much effort from teachers, and they resort to ways that are easier and that are more responsive. Response times to technology challenges, which are mostly fixable software and network issues, have to be timely and efficient in order for teachers to use the technology. You know, many districts recognize this issue, and they're including the technology department in curricular and planning discussions, and also monitoring their response times and trying to lower them. And a new model of distributed roles within public and private partners is also taking hold here. And then lastly, the barriers exist when addressing issues and changing any instructional model, and especially if collaborating across schools and districts. We're really lucky to have our digital teaching initiative districts that are familiar in addressing many of these things. They've learned that things like logistical changes of common schedules, like vacations and calendars and daily bell schedules, the way schools and districts accept and grant credit, the differences between them, having administrative and technical staffing available and making sure that they're there, what job description changes are needed, and also how to get policy alignment there with actual practices. So I think those are the barriers that I see, and some of the areas that need attention. And I have a next step suggestion to make, but I'll check in with you to take any questions on that portion.
Are there any questions for members?
I'd like to hear his next steps. And then
okay, we'll wait. Continue, Dr. Wicker.
Okay, great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So lastly, what can we do? Schools are working to provide the best education possible to their kids. And, you know, just following along with your hearings and all the information you've gathered, we really appreciate your support of these ideas to develop a sustained model of education. with assistance in the right tools, schools can accelerate the rate of modernization of instructional models. And we have much of what we need to make this happen. A statewide system of support could provide opportunity for voluntary participation and local control and input that best addresses the children of their community and that community's aspiration for its children. So while there's several ways to move forward, I'd like to paint a vision of one. The development of an innovative school network of leading school districts would help us move forward as a state. The foundational pieces for this statewide approach are in place, and the basis for this network is already established through the Digital Teaching Initiative grantee districts and others, most of which have testified before you. The Digital Teaching Initiative experience has led to the development of common recommendations and strategies. Their efforts have a level of scalability that could impact the vast majority of our students in the very near future. Combining their knowledge with the knowledge gained by the Consortium for Digital Learning and other innovative districts and organizations that directly supports this transition could provide consolidated purchasing, professional development, technical services, liaison to stakeholders and providers, and common and consistent approaches to solving these issues that form the basis of this educational transformation. You know, through this network, systems to promote, develop, incentivize, and administer the use of technology in high-quality, inspirational, and effective ways can be developed. That includes well-trained and well-prepared teachers and learning coaches, high access to technology, central sources of administrative, technical, curricular, and implementation support centered on the learner, high-quality distance and blended learning program that's collaborative, administered, delivered, and received at distance, a central organized system of learning management and video teleconferencing capabilities that acts as vetted, high-quality content, organized resources, and assesses outcomes, and the high-quality professional development that we need delivered in a tiered, blended learning model. You know, we know at the Consortium for Digital Learning that there are potential significant cost savings over time with changes in the delivery of professional development. We've seen that even in the case of double robots implementation. That's just one instance. Curriculum and in instructional material, we've seen that in applications, simple applications and software that students and teachers can use and that are free or inexpensive, and hardware purchasing. We've done that consolidated buy before and can do it again. Our basis for this determination has come from our experience of initiating high-access learning environments that maximize the use of broadband that have been sustainable over time. You know, for the past 12 years, the Association of Alaska School Boards has made significant commitment by hiring staff and garnering funds to expressly move our member districts forward with digital learning, modernization, and innovation. You know, we're very excited about the ideas that are being generated by the series of hearings you've conducted, and we're standing ready to assist and work with the legislature and the Department of Education in any way that we can. So that concludes my testimony, and I'll be glad to respond to any questions that you might have.
Senator Begich.
Hi, Bob. It's Tom Begich, and I very much appreciated your presentation. Senator Dunleavy says I should put on the record that I was involved with the Moore lawsuit and the Casile lawsuits on the plaintiff's side, so I want to put that on the record for you guys before I jump. I'm not involved any longer with those, but I wanted to say one of the things about Moore was one of the difficulties in the Moore lawsuit, Bob, was it identified that there were certain types of delivery of education that needed to be done to be to essentially meet our constitutional obligation under the education clause of the Constitution. And those were really quite significantly defined. But the plaintiffs wanted to be absolutely sure that this didn't come down to a money argument, which is why technology and this vision makes some sense to not just the state side, but to, in that lawsuit, the plaintiff's side, and then obviously to everybody here. And Chairman Hughes has outlined what I believe is not just an ambitious but a visionary approach to applying technology in an appropriate way so that we're not reducing the ability of our students to learn on one hand, and at the same time we are making sure that our students have access to as much of these elements that were identified for education on the other hand. So I'm excited about the idea of the survey, the idea of surveying to find out what our current bandwidth is, and potentially some low-cost effort. $500,000 seems rather excessive, but you've indicated that that could be cheaper. So I'm excited from a 50,000-foot level to see what our broadband needs are. I very much appreciated knowing the different approaches that are there and the segmentation you did in the presentation, because that really helps us out. I'm saying all this because I want to say a few things about the general stuff, and then I want to drill down to a couple questions about the technology you've described. So in terms of the general stuff that you've talked about, the first thing is that we have to be sure that if we do elevate our schools, and the 2014 survey, as the chairman pointed out, shows that half the schools were under even the minimum bandwidth, and none of them exceeded the maximum bandwidth. Even the five largest ones didn't. You know, there were five larger school districts that did. So the first thing I want to be sure we do is, if we do upgrades and this level of teaching that we're talking about, that we also, wouldn't you agree that we should also, because technology, as you pointed out in your testimony, is not static, but that it changes over time, that we have to have a way to replenish technology, both in rural and urban areas, much like we do maybe, I'm suggesting the school maintenance or the school construction funds. Doesn't there need to be some kind of ongoing effort that ensures that that some districts don't fall behind and others stay ahead? That's a question.
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Baggage, thank you for that question. And your points are all well taken. I think the simple answer to that is yes. There has to be a way to replenish technology, and schools who have made major investments in technology are getting better and better at coming around to what I call to a refresh schedule. But that takes a mind shift, because we've really purchased technology in the past on the basis that we're looking for funds, one-time funds, whatever, grants, however we get it. And we look at it as equipment rather than really supplies. And if you're going to have, as in the case in our high-access learning environments, a sustainable model, you have to look at the equipment as being refreshed every year. Now, that doesn't mean you refresh all of it every year, but you have to have a schedule that makes sense within your budget so that you never get behind. The way that this has gone in the past is districts will make a large purchase, and then they'll wait until the equipment, is 4 to 5 years old, and in some cases, some of our districts, actually, they don't refresh until they're 10 years old. And by that time, the repair costs and the just keeping it up and running costs almost as much as buying a new one. So what districts have been moving to is that refresh cycle that is in a constant refresh mode, and that flattens the expenditure out, so that every year I count on this much coming through rather than a $1 million purchase in this year, not much the next, and then another $1 million purchase later on. Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, yes, it does make sense. And to follow up?
Yeah, and I just want to give a time check because we do have a bill. So we have about 10 minutes, and Senator Coghill may have a question depending if you ask it for him. He may not. And I also have a couple short answer questions. So let's try to be really compact so we can get the information we need.
I'm pleased to say that I had to get the intro done, but now I'm just down to the questions. So it does make sense to me, and I like the idea of a broadband spread out over time that we want to bring broadband to scale, so that's the first piece. And then the second piece appears to be the need for some kind of regular funding mechanism to ensure that our broadband doesn't fall off the planet. And, you know, we're responsible for the unorganized borough here, but the rest of the taxing places could do that anyway. You talked about training and technology, and this is really important to me. Obviously, there's a need to train up teachers, and I love the concept of the collaborative, which is like a fourth component here, the collaborative where we share bell times and we collaborate, pick and choose. But you wouldn't want to sacrifice the ability of local districts to have things that might be specifically important to cultural learning, such as the UPIC curriculums that have been developed in UPIT and CHEVAC and those areas, would you?
Through the chair, Senator Benkes, no, very much not. And I think there are ways, and I think you've had some testimony in different types of, you know, collaboration that smaller districts can actually use, as in the case of Copper River, let's say, where they have remodeled their revamped their whole yearly calendar into treks and base camps, 2 weeks for this, 4 weeks for that, which allows a whole year class to keep going, but you've still got time for other things before. And I think that's our holy grail, is distance delivery that is high quality instruction, standards-based, place-based, localized, and project-based. Now, that's a mouthful, but I think that is a real possible thing now, and it has to do with our foundational approaches that we've been pursuing for these past few years. It's kind of a convergence time in my mind.
Thanks, Bob. And then I just have actually one last one related to a very specific topic. Is that okay, Madam Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
So now I'm going to drill right down to robot technology. And, you know, a claim that you made here at the end that it actually saved you money. And I just want to be sure I understand how robot technology works. It's still the teacher running the robot. Is that, it's a series of little pieces here. So is that correct? A teacher's running the robot.
It could be anybody running that robot.
Wait, Bob, before you go there, anybody could run the robot, but you talked about the robot going from student to student and offering them advice and support. Now, isn't that a teacher, or is that me, or is it somebody who, I mean, that concerns me. I want to be sure that if a robot is moving from student to student, that it's providing support, and that's still a teacher, isn't it?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Begich. In the case that I've seen that happening in Kodiak, but I also know that their main delivery model right now is not through a robot; it's through a classroom teacher. The support is coming to those classroom teachers and the professional development from people that are outside of the district.
Exactly, Bob. So it's adding that quality that we can't otherwise get to a rural village, which the Florida people and the New York people testified to. It's actually saying we know we can't provide a quality teacher in every category to this village, but what we can do is use this mode of teaching alongside a teacher to ensure that that we access quality education. And the robots cost about $2,500, and at the least, according to the internet anyway. Who knows if the internet's accurate, maybe fake. But it costs about $2,500, and if the robot breaks down, you have to ensure that there's tech on site or somebody who flies in to repair the robot. Is that not correct?
Yes, Through the chair, yes, Senator Begich. And I think that's the key to a lot of this, is having those systems of support in place.
I love the idea, Bob. So the question is then, where are the potential significant cost savings from the double robot? If it's a teacher that's providing the instruction, so you're paying for that teacher, and if they're moving from person to person, they're actually working the classroom. You have the classroom teacher still there. I love the idea of being able to provide the higher education, but I don't want to mislead, if you will, and that's a harsh word, but I don't want the committee to be left with the impression that somehow that lowers the cost. What it does is enhances the education experience for those kids, which I think is critically valuable and should be done.
Yes, through the chair, I would agree with you here, and I think the cost savings that we've seen now has to do with the delivery of professional development for teachers. So rather than we hire or fly people up to a district and be involved with, you know, this personal type of professional development, that double robot has saved that money, okay? All the travel time, et cetera, et cetera. In the instance of the coach in Kodiak pulling that team together, I mean, that you could call that direct instruction, and that has saved, well, it saved money if you would ever try to bring that team together. But quite frankly, I don't think that was even a consideration until they came up with this solution. So as far as having a robot in a classroom by themselves with a teacher on it, that would be something that I think. Talking to someone with more experience about that, which I would recommend talking to Superintendent McDonald. He could probably tell you a better story about that.
Thank you, Bob, very much.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Worker, and I appreciate the work that you've done. So in the Fairbanks area and probably other areas where you do have a fair degree of broadband, but you also have school tech catch-up, what are some of the things that some of the students are doing that are maybe ahead of what we can do in the school itself? And are there ways that we can take advantage of that in some of the outlying areas where they actually have access to both devices and some Wi-Fi or broadband at home? Is that something that you've factored into some of your thinking?
Through the chair, if I understand your question correctly, Senator Coghill, one of the things I used to do was direct, and I created a couple of the homeschool correspondence programs, and that we saw students doing all kinds of things that I would say were beyond what they might have gotten within a public school, because it was highly individualized and it was highly accelerated for them, right? So having the right technology set up helps that. And you were kind of talking about wireless at home, that kind of thing. I think that when you get into the real life, real world learning, being out into the community, that's where we see kids kind of doing more than what school gives them credit for. And we Association of Alaska School Boards actually sponsored a day on personalized learning at their last annual conference, where we were talking about bringing business communities in, major mentoring programs, apprenticeships, that kind of thing. That's where I would see that you see maybe kids doing more, if indeed I'm answering the question that you're asking.
And I won't belabor it, but I know in the Fairbanks area, the youngsters are probably a lot more tech savvy and have a lot of access outside of the schoolroom. And we actually had some of our schools hardwired that they're trying to use both the hardwire, and the kids are Wi-Fi savvy. They're taking their courses outside of the school to speed things up a little bit. And so those are self-started. I get that, but there also reminds me that there might be places in rural Alaska where we have slow at the school, but they might have access at home that can help them. I was just wondering if that had been brought into the discussion at all. But that's something I'll just keep snooping around on.
Okay. And we're really tight on time, Dr. Wicker, so I'm going to give you, we're going to do rapid fire on my three questions, okay? So I want your answers to be really, really short, okay? I want to know, because I heard a little bit of discrepancy in some of the hearings between what districts would say the type of bandwidth they're getting and then from some of the providers what was available. Do we have situations where districts, where there might be more broadband available in the community, but the district is not purchasing it all because of the cost factor? So do we have some where there is actually more bandwidth available, but the district is not purchasing it? Is that happening? Is that a yes?
Yes. That is a definite yes.
Okay, and if you would be willing to follow up with that and give us an idea of some of the districts and communities where that is happening, that would be very helpful. I want to also ask you, this innovative network, which is something that we are looking at promoting something like this, so I really appreciate your wrap-up where you had the bullets of different things of what you think that might look like. Do you think in order for districts to really move forward in this, we're going to have to begin, as much as we all love and want to maintain local control, that we're going to have to start thinking about shared bell schedules and shared calendars to really make this work across the state?
I'm thinking, Senator Hughes. I think that there's going to have to be a system that allows this to happen. Now, whether it's going to be shared bell systems and calendars, that could be something that maybe happen in a regional type of a place. But I think there's, it kind of goes back to the premise that I always talked about in the beginning. You take the constraints that you have, and then you work with what you have to make it work. So I think it is definitely workable. I don't think that you have to go to a standard bell system or calendar. No.
Okay. Well, thank you for that input. I know there are some people that think that we probably need to move more that direction. So thank you very much. My last question, and I'll just it's follow up after Senator Begich about the teachers and using the robot. I'm envisioning in a small school where you have K-12, one teacher, and you really want that live teacher teaching the young children to read, for instance, that if the robot were doing a two-way virtual class with the high schoolers, that perhaps that the person in the room with those high schoolers could be in a homegrown local village instructional aide, and then that you could have the certified teacher at the other end, so that the certified teacher in that small school during that time period might be working with the young children in a live setting. Do you see that as a possibility? Because I get that sense that we could, just like we have health aides in the clinics and the doctors on the other end, that we could perhaps use instructional aides to a greater degree with the proper training. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, Senator Hughes, I think there is a model that would be effective, that would be something like what you just described. Whether it's a robot or not, I think that's kind of something, anything new, you have to make sure if you're going to go for it, as that being the main thing, you need to kind of make sure that it works. But I think that model that you just described in general principle, quite frankly, is a workable model.
Okay, thank you very much. We really appreciate your being with us today, Dr. Wicker, and And if members have further questions, I'm sure we could get those to Dr. Wicker, and he's an expert, and you've been a wonderful resource, and we probably will be in touch with you more as we move forward with this. At this point, we're going to move on to SB 66, and I am going to invite my staff, Joshua Banks, to the table, who is going to present the sectional analysis. This is a committee bill, and following that, we'll have two council members who are online. One is the executive director, and that is Andrea Noble Pellant. I may be mispronouncing that, and a council member, Alice Bioff, and I may be mispronouncing that one too. But I'll just give a brief introduction. I've had conversations with committee members, so I think you're familiar, but Senate Bill 66 will quasi-privatize the Alaska State Council on the Arts by restructuring it as a public corporation, and this new status will allow the council to increase its ability to leverage non-governmental funds and better adapt to the shifting economic climate in Alaska. This effort responds to widespread interest in governmental entities to at least partially privatize their operations and increase their operating efficiency. So now we will turn it over to Joshua Banks. Go ahead, Joshua.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. For the record, my name is Joshua Banks, staff to Senator Hughes and the Senate Education Committee. Today I'll be going over the sectional for the for Senate Bill 66 relating to the Alaska State Council on the Arts. And as the Chair Hughes mentioned, we do have Ben Brown in the room and Andrea Noble Quant online to answer questions regarding this bill or the Arts Council. So starting with Section 1, it will include the Executive Director and all employees of the Arts Council as employees that are exempt under the State Personnel Act under AS 3925. Section 2 will allow artist submission for Arts Council funding to be exempt from public records requests under AS 40-25-120A, and as we'll see later in the bill, this confidentiality is temporary, only for while the Board of Trustees decides if the artist is going to receive funding from the Council. Section 3 repeals and reenacts AS 44-27-040 by setting up the Arts Council as a public corporation. The Arts Council will remain within the Department of Education and Early Development. Section 4 establishes that the Council will now be a Board of Trustees. This section also creates new requirements for the board membership so that they must represent literary arts, and that instead of members just having an interest in art, they must have an expertise in the arts. Section 5 makes similar changes by substituting terms members for trustees, Council for Board of Trustees, and adding the literary arts to the type of groups that, and associations that the governor must consult when making appointments to the board. Section 6 changes the term member to trustee. Section 7 also changes the term members of the council to trustees and changes the language regarding the council's ability to pay per diem and reimburse travel expenses for council members to include the statutory reference of AS 3921A, and this section essentially allows members of the council to get equal payments for per diem and travel costs equal to what other state boards and commissions receive. Section 8 changes the terminology under AS 4427045 to be gender neutral, and also changes members of the council to trustees and council to board trustees. Section 9 creates new duties for the Arts Council to promote literary arts, encourage the investment in all of the arts, and to conduct research on artistic and cultural activities. Section 10 substitutes the term education for strategic in order to reflect the role that the Arts Council involves more than just educational objectives. Section 11 changes the terminology under AS 4427054 to again use gender-neutral terms, and changes council to trustees. This section also makes a conforming amendment to the exemption to the State Personnel Act made in Section 1 of this bill. Section 12 adds a new section to AS 4427, how the Arts Council will be administered. Subsection A will allow the Board of Trustees to manage the Council's assets and adopt, amend, and repeal bylaws and regulations pertaining to the council. Subsection B allows the board to hire an executive director to supervise the administration of the council. Subsection C exempts the council from the state procurement code, but it requires the council to adopt its own procurement code, and it requires it to include a veteran's preference consistent with AS 3630321F. Subsection D requires that the council's operating budget be subject to the Executive Budget Act under AS 3707. Section 13 requires the council to comply with 20 U.S.C. 951 through 960, which is the National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities Act of 1965. This requires the state to provide matching funds for any funds received by the National Endowment for the Arts. Section 14 creates new subsections under AS 4427060. Subsection E allows for an artist's submission to the council to be confidential and not subject to public inspection or disclosure under the Public Records Act. And under subsection F, any submission that is confidential under E will no longer be confidential if the council awards a commission. If no commission is awarded, then the council will notify the artist and return the submission. Subsection G provides that if an artist's submission is a work made for hire or if the artist has transferred the copyright, the confidentiality provisions under this section do not apply. Section 15 creates definitions for Board of Trustees, being the Board of Trustees of the Alaska State Council of the Arts, and for Council, meaning the Alaska State Council of the Arts. Section 16 creates transition language for the following areas of the Arts Council. First, the council, current council members will now be on the Board of Trustees. Second, current employees will remain working with the council. Also, regulations, contracts, rights, liabilities, and obligations created under current law will remain in effect. And finally, the Arts Council as a corporation will retain records, equipment, appropriations, and other property currently held by the council. And last, section 17 creates an effective date for this bill to be July 1st, 2017. With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Joshua. Are there questions from members? Joshua, I have one question, just in, particularly for those that might be listening. In Section 12, it allows the hiring of an executive director, but we're not adding a new position. Is that correct?
No, I'm sure that's correct. There is currently an executive director.
Okay. Senator Coghill.
A couple of questions. So in the transition, the members now become trustees. But they may not fit the qualifications. So is there a timeline? I just haven't seen through. Is there a timeline for the trustees to be in? And I just haven't read it yet.
Madam Chair, that may be a question for either Ben or Andrew online.
Okay. And Madam Chair, we can get those. I'll get another question on the table, and then maybe they can answer both of them. I'm always reluctant to put U.S. code requirements in our statute because we never know if what part is the tail and what part is the dog sometimes. So in Section 13, those requirements are something that we should probably get on the record. So if you have them, fine. If you need somebody to tell us what those requirements are, it's probably matching money, but I'd like to know what that is and if the trustees have a new responsibility under this.
Through the Chair, Senator Cago, we can provide that, or the council will be able to provide that as well.
All right. Any other questions before we bring Benjamin Brown up? Thank you, Joshua. Good job. Benjamin, please come up and introduce yourself for the record and share with us why this bill is important.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Benjamin Brown, Chairman of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. My pleasure to be here with the Senate Education Committee this Friday morning. The bill is here because we have spent the better part of the last year as a council thinking about ways to respond to the state's fiscal crisis and some of our experiences as a council but our staff's experiences that have arisen even before the state was in such dire fiscal straits. There were just some things that were not working as well as they could have done under the strictures of being a mainline state agency. basically, with the advent of more and more private foundation money coming into the council's operations, we've been hamstrung by things like the procurement code. And when we thought it was, we knew it would be necessary to have legislation to exempt us from that, we thought, well, we don't want to be coming back every 2 years asking for a new bill, so let's put together a package of what we think are the best and brightest ways to make the council a more effective organization, put it all together, and we're very grateful that the Senate Education Committee was willing to listen to our request as a bunch of volunteer council members, and we're also grateful that on the other side of the building, the House Education Committee has a companion piece of legislation. So, you know, in a nutshell, we're trying to be part of the solution and not part of the problem, and we think that this bill will enable ASCA to move into a new era after 50 years of being a really good public resource that uses the very minimal amount of public money necessary to do as much good work as possible. And that actually segues into one of Senator Coghill's questions, Madam Chairman. The National Arts and Humanities Act is the shorter name for 20 U.S.C. 951 through 960. It mandates that state arts agencies be parts of state government. And so even if this were not put into our enabling statute, the mandate would exist. It also mandates that every dollar that we get, and there's some narrow exceptions, but for the most part, every dollar a state arts agency gets from the National Endowment for the Arts has to be matched dollar for dollar. One exception I can give you coming up next Tuesday evening is the Poetry Out Loud competition. That was the brainchild of former NEA Chairman Dana Gioia. Those funds don't require a dollar for dollar match, although I'll tell you by the time we're done, we're probably doing more dollar for dollar in kind. But that doesn't mandate that the legislature come up for a dollar for that particular program. But on the whole, since the mid-90s, Congress has mandated that 40% of all the money that goes to the National Endowment for the Arts be passed through to the state arts agencies as a means of making sure it's not going disproportionately to the West or East Coast or large cultural institutions, but it's going out to each state and jurisdiction, leveraging that dollar-for-dollar match, and then going into local communities where it leverages more money, and the decisions are being made at a local level. You know, if all politics are local, all arts should be local, too, and that's what the 40% does. So we thought putting the reference to the National Arts and Humanities Act into the statute just clarified, if anyone ever wanted to go pull the blue book off the shelf and say, what is the State Council on the Arts and what's its relationship with the NEA, there would be a clear reference there to what the federal requirements are. But if this didn't go in, we'd still have to be a state agency, and we'd still have to match the dollar for dollar. So to answer that question, Madam Chairman, for Senator Coghill, it doesn't add any new requirements for the council or the trustees. So I know we're a little bit pressed for time this morning. So I know Andrea Noble-Pallant, who is our executive director, had some testimony she wanted to provide, and then one of our council members, Alice Bioff of NOME, also had some testimony she wanted to provide. So I'd almost prefer to allow them to do that, but I'm certainly happy to answer questions. And for the record, Senator Giesel and Senator Stevens, I'll go meet with them individually if they have any questions, and that's true for all of you, of course. Anything I can do outside the committee context to give you any more information about the legislation, I'm very happy to do. But I would say it's certainly not fired from the hip. We've been spending a lot of time over the last year thinking about what we wanted to put into this bill, and so we are pretty cautious about what's here, and so I think I'll be able to answer any specific questions about its contents or anything that you don't see in there that you think might need to be in there.
And we are going to be holding this bill over, and hopefully you'll be able to be back, so if we have additional questions, because I have a few, but I also wanted to, these wonderful ladies have been waiting online this entire through the prior presentation, and it's one log in at 7:54 a.m. and one at 7:50 a.m. So Alice is in Nome. So Alice, would you like to talk to us about this bill, please? Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Honorable Committee Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 66. My name is Alice Bioff. I'm a resident of Nome, Alaska, currently employed at COWARIC and also an Alaska State Council on the Arts Council member. Thank you all for the opportunity to testify in support of SB 66. I am testifying today in my capacity as a ASCA council member. I am a tribal member of the Native Village of Koyuk and grew up there and in Nome. My family and I have lived in Nome for the last 17 years. For much of that time, I have been employed by COWARIC, the regional nonprofit consortium of tribes for the Bering Straits region, as a business planning specialist. Through our work here at COWARIC, I am honored and privileged to work with artist entrepreneurs within our communities. We provide direct technical assistance, offering tools and resources to assist artists continue their work so that they could sustain themselves, their families, and their communities. It is through this work that I have seen firsthand how important it is for these artists who live in communities with very few resources and infrastructure to grow their businesses through opportunities such as those that become available through ASCA and other organizations. Artist entrepreneurs are economic development drivers in their communities, and the Alaska State Council on the Arts support these communities through their work and advocacy. With their partnerships, resources, and programs, we see a bright future and growth opportunity to support all artists across the state. Through the restructuring initiative, we see ASCA services continued and strengthened and support the artists through improved ability to react to funding opportunities and better represent, support, and advance the artists by offering the tools and services needed to strengthen an already existing and important economy. This is critical to strengthening and sustaining our rural communities in this fiscally challenging time. SB 66 streamlines the process ASCA will use to present opportunities to artists all over Alaska, including those artists we have worked with for years here in the Bering Straits region. From my perspective, this would be a great benefit for all artists, including those in rural Alaska. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Alice, for your testimony. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate your perseverance to hang on all this time. And next we have Andrea, the Executive Director of Alaska Council on the Arts, coming to us from Anchorage. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair Hughes. Honorable committee and committee members, my name is Andrea Noble-Pallant. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. I have worked for this agency for 11 years and in the arts sector for almost 30 years. The Alaska State Council on the Arts is now in its 51st year and is ready to undergo organizational change. The timing of SB 66 is opportune as Alaska's creative industry is currently growing due to targeted public and private investment in the sector in the past 10 years. As a result, the Alaska State Council on the Arts has experienced rapid growth in grants, programs, and public-private partnerships. We wish to continue this effort for the benefit of all Alaskans, and with the provisions in SB 66, the Alaska State Council on the Arts is poised to continue grant-making as a public corporation that will also allow new and existing programs to reach more Alaskans with increased impact and efficiency. Our agency is known for working with our trusted constituents who trust us. We work on local, national, and international levels to oversee projects and initiatives that build capacity for arts organizations and provide practical professional development and opportunities for individual artists. Our work boosts students' chances for success through arts and education and through mutually beneficial alliances with public-private sector partners. Our reach extends to military service members and their families who experience PTSD, incarcerated individuals, pre-service teachers, Alaskan children and youth who want opportunities to learn through arts and culture, and parents who want to raise their families in safe, sustainable communities. That is a far leap from the grant-making organization that we used to be. Long-standing partnerships are in place with the Rasmussen Foundation, the Alaska Arts and Culture Foundation, and the Atwood Foundation. New partners include Margaret A. Cargill Philanthropies, the Siri Foundation, and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. And those new partners were inspired by our work, and we saw together how we could accomplish more. Other partners include the Alaska Humanities Forum and the Western States Arts Federation, which contribute in-kind support, resources, and funding. keeping with our mission, this is critical. Funding from our partners goes back to Alaska residents and communities as grants, programs, and services. SB 66 provides flexibility for us to manage fast-flow projects in a timely manner and to work across sectors such as health, economic development, tourism, and transportation, where arts and culture can have a greater impact. SB 66 allows for responsive project execution that is necessary for these desired collaborative outcomes, which affect our performance evaluations and our ability to secure future funding. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Again, also appreciate your patience and your testimony. And Ben has a closing comment. It is 1 minute after our meeting time, so short and sweet,
yes,
Benjamin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I did not respond to Senator Coghill's other inquiry about expertise of council members. So, Madam Chairman, if I may, Senator Coghill, all the current members of the council have expertise in one of the enumerated arts areas right now. And the difference between expertise and interest is something that Mr. Schoenfeld actually asked me in the story he did on KTOO, which is in the materials your aide put in there. But everyone on the council certainly has expertise in these areas now, and I think going forward the governor's office would continue to vet potential council members in that way. So that's also not a problem with the transition. Thank you for letting me add that, Madam Chairman, and we look forward to coming back before the committee whenever you'd like to have us back.
Thank you very much, and appreciate your answering that other question. So we are going to hold this bill until next Friday. And our next meeting will be Monday at 8 a.m., and it will be a joint meeting with the House Education. And we're going to hear from Mark Foster with Commonwealth North. They worked on the report and recommendations regarding the state operating budget, and we've asked him to focus on education. And so look forward to that very much. And so seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn at 9:32.